We need them all. So you need a level of influence around your membership, and you need a level of experience. So again, I'll go back to the Virginia model. When it was Jerry and Lisa and I who were the main people getting up in front of our people. And at that time, we never surveyed our members. We felt in our heart of hearts we needed laser in Virginia. So we said, here's the plan, here's the time frame, here's what we're going to do. And at the time that we unveiled that to our people, we also had some people who were older, who were going to be able to stand up to say, I did this in the 90s. I said back in the 90s, I don't think we need glaucoma. I was wrong. We need this, and we need to build this over time.
Hello and welcome to the Crystal Podcast on iCode Media. Today I had a great conversation with my good friend, Dr. Jeff Michaels, out in Virginia. We discussed scope of practice. We discussed State Government Relations Committee. We discussed the types of things that we need to think about as a profession to make sure that we're able to serve our patients and our populations in our state to the best of our ability. Please enjoy our conversation. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, write a review, share it with your friends, and support those who support us.
As you know, patients with vitreous floaters are often frustrated by their symptoms. The challenge as clinicians is to offer solutions for our patients for vitreous floaters that are effective. But more often than not, the options of YAG vitreolysis and vitrectomy are not practical because the benefits don't outweigh the risks. That's where Vitreous Health from MacuHealth comes into play. Previously on the podcast, I've discussed the FLIES study with Dr. John Nolan, and the bottom line is that I can be confident prescribing this for my patients with floaters because I can tell them a large randomized placebo-controlled trial found that after 6 months of supplementation with Vitreous Health, floaters were reduced in size by approximately 30%, and 70% of patients had an improvement in their symptoms. Vitreous Health has been great for my patients, and we really feel like we have a viable option to treat patients with vitreous floaters now that we didn't have before. If you're not utilizing Vitreous Health for your patients, reach out to your MacuHealth representative now. I want to discuss the MyDay toric contact lens for a minute. When I'm reaching for a daily lens for my patients, I need to know that it will be available in the parameters I want, and it also needs to work. This improves my chair time and my patient satisfaction. The MyDay toric lens features the same optical lens design features as the most prescribed monthly replacement toric lens on the market, the Biofinity toric. MyDay toric now completely mirrors Biofinity toric's parameter range, and to be clear, this means that if you can find a parameter in the Biofinity toric, you can find it in the MyDay toric. This toric lens design is multifaceted to ensure optimal visual acuity, lens stability, fit, and comfort. Its uniform horizontal ISO thickness and wide ballast band quickly orient the lens for better performance and simplified fitting processes. When prescribing MyDay contact lenses, you can feel confident about your environmental impact because for every MyDay contact lens sold in the United States, CooperVision's partner, Plastic Bank, collects and converts an equal amount of ocean-bound plastic through their global network. The MyDay multifocal and MyDay toric contact lenses will provide your patients with great vision quality and comfortable lens experience, all while making a difference in our environment. So if you haven't started utilizing MyDay multifocal in your practice, I'd encourage you to reach out to your CooperVision representative to get started.
So I'm going to get right into it. I think it's always better to do an introduction after we do our conversation, because I don't know exactly where our conversation is going to go.
Yep.
You know, Dr. Michaels, when you were on last time, we talked about, it was actually, it was almost 2 years ago, because you guys had just passed your scope of practice law. And Now you've been on the tour within SGRC all over the country, helping other states do what you all did. So then I've seen that, and you and I have interacted with each other over the last couple of years multiple times. But I wanted to give you a platform here to talk about what you're seeing in other states and kind of what's driving you. I would guess, I mean, I don't think this is your why, honestly, but I would guess you have a nice clear path to the AOA board and at some point an AOA president. You and Jerry, I would guess, are probably have a trajectory that way if you'd like it. But I don't think that's necessarily your why. I also want to point out, hopefully, so at the time of recording this, you're probably aware, but South Dakota has passed their scope of practice bill through the House and through the Senate, and it's sitting on the governor's desk for the last 2 days. So basically, she's got 2 days. So by the time, we'll either know, it's either done or it's a law by the time this gets posted. So that's kind of the setup.
Thinking about that one.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be huge.
Yeah, actually, right before I came on with you, I was hitting refresh to see did the governor sign in South Dakota yet, because that one I've been watching really close. And the governor gets 5 days and has till Saturday. It's been awesome.
Is it 5 business days?
You know, that's the question. Is it 5 days or 5 business days? Saturday, it went to her desk on the 27th.
Yep.
So I don't know if that's considered Saturday or Monday. I was hoping for a Friday treat.
Yeah, I am too. I was too. So tell me a little bit. So let's start. We could speculate, but let's not speculate on South Dakota. Mm-hmm. Let's just say some prayers and hope that it doesn't go the way of California did a couple of years ago.
I'll tell you.
You know, that one really bothered me because it was like, there were in journal articles, I don't know if you remember this, but in journal articles, they were publishing things online. Congratulations, California, blah, 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 blah. I was like, wait. And I actually responded to a couple. I was like, you got to stop this, because this is like, and it did. I was like, the governor hasn't signed. This is not a done deal.
So you
remember that?
I vividly remember your comments. I remember being in the same camp as you and just thinking, man, this is too soon. And, you know, the media in some of the journals, you know, it's their job to publish stuff like that. But we use this philosophy in Virginia that we would not grant an interview with anybody until after the governor signed. And so I vividly remember your remarks. I vividly remember all of that. And I've used that and remember that all the time when I tell people. So when I talked to South Dakota after it passed and was awaiting for its first signature, I immediately texted Justin Schweitzer and their executive director and said, we're still not granting any interviews whatsoever. South Dakota's been awesome. I've worked with South Dakota intimately for the past 6 months or so. We put all of their key persons through some very detailed training. We gave them a list of words. Here's what you say. Here's what you don't say when you're talking to a legislator. And as a part of that process was, you do not grant an interview to anybody at any time until after the governor signs.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to work with Nick Wynandy? Do you remember?
No.
I think Nick did some testimony a couple weeks ago. And anyway, he's great.
Alex Perman is a good.
And then Alex Perman is a really great key contact that I've gotten to know both of those guys up there. I know Justin, of course, but I wanted to give those two guys, Alex Perman and Nick Wynandy, are guys I know personally that I wanted to give a shout out because they did a lot of work. Hopefully it's fruitful.
They did, South Dakota did a great job. We did a Zoom with them. I did a Zoom with them a couple of days before testimony, and it was basically testimony preparation. They would give a question, the ODs would answer it, and then I would give my answer, and they sort of morphed all of their full, when they were live, they morphed them all, and it came off super duper well. So I think that the testimony preparation is something that people don't emphasize enough. And look, as you already know, you're never going to win based on your testimony, but you could lose based on your testimony. And South Dakota did a really fantastic job of their preparation for being able to answer the questions live. And what's interesting about South Dakota is the optometrists give their part, the ophthalmologists give their part, but then for like another hour, it's just Q&A, and they're just pummeling ODs and MDs with questions about the logistics of this. And that's what South Dakota really focused on, and I thought they did just a fantastic job.
Yeah, that's awesome. Let's broaden out a little bit. So South Dakota is in my backyard, but you know, you've been to a number of different states. Now I haven't. So SGRC, I've basically been off SGRC now for a few months. I was sort of fading out into the sunset last year. We lost Daniel. Daniel kind of moved on, moved up and moved on. Tell me a little bit about what the committee is focused on, State Government Relations Committee within the AOA. Obviously, you know, this is public, so there's things that we won't talk about, but you know, what are you seeing in other states, just as an OD helping other ODs, what are you seeing in other states that excites you about where the profession is at and our opportunities for the future?
So first and foremost, Chris Wolf does not get phased out of SGRC. He's got to move on to some family things, but still a pillar and a resource for every state around the country. Your experience and your leadership helped to set the trajectory of SGRC and where it is today.
Wow,
what I see is awesome. It's a lot of states really taking a hardcore look at what their scope is and how can they advance it. And so, you know, it was a phenomena of the 80s for diagnostics. It was a phenomena in the 90s for therapeutics. It was a phenomena in the 2000s for orals. And now the phenomena is being able to really practice at the height of what we're educated and trained to do. And so I'm excited because a lot of states are looking at it from a perspective of how can we set the next 3 or 4 years to help get us to where we need to be. And I never claim that the Virginia model is the only model. Clearly that never works in Nebraska and what you guys have to do. But at the heart of what we did was let's create a strategic plan around this idea of scope. Let's set some milestones. Let's really hone in on relationships with everybody across the board. And so the one thing that I see today is that the relationship piece, which is really ultimately what's going to carry a bill, is all over the place. And we've got some states where if you have 160 legislators, 60% of them are covered by an OD and know who their optometrist is. And that just leaves a lot of opportunity for growth and for understanding how is it that we pass a bill. And I'll go back to one more thing that we did in Virginia. I think it was the first time that we passed scope where we didn't ask our lobbyists and our ED to be the main torch bearer of this. What we did was we put 3 or 4 optometrists in charge of creating the messaging, creating the snowball of motivating our members and getting them to really hone in on the fact that this is going to be a big group effort.
When you go to different states and you're assessing whether or not they are ready to go, what are the kinds of things that you're looking for to say from the optometrist? Because I think that's right. I think there's this battle, and a battle is not the best way to think about it, but it's probably a relatively accurate way to think about it is between, as you say, the lobbyists and the ED, and then the rank and file OD. So what I see as a problem is that the rank and file OD abdicates their responsibility to the ED and to the lobbyists because they're the hired guns. And then they just think, well, we're paying them to do that, and so they're going to do it. Or we're paying the third party, or you know, the legislative chair, or the third party chair is going to do this, and so I don't really need to mess with that. And so that's when I was going across the country, I would see that. And it's not the ED's fault, and it's not the lobbyist's fault, and it's not even so much that, I mean, I think you could probably place blame somewhat on the legislative chair, but it's not even their fault. It's the kind of groundswell of ODs right underneath them or right next to them that are kind of like, I'm busy and I'm pretty happy. So how do you get over that?
Man, there's so much to unwind there. I agree. It's not a blame game. Okay, so I'm working with a state right now that did not successfully pass scope this year. And we could all sit back and blame one person or two persons, but really at the end of the day, it comes down to, did you have enough relationships across the vast majority of your legislators to be able to pass this law? And I don't know, I'm not aware of a state that can that doesn't pass scope that had like 99% of all of their legislators were covered by an optometrist who met with the optometrist who, in terms of scope, I'll say, who put the legislator through laser demos or whatever the case may be. It just doesn't happen. And so I'm definitely not about the blame game. I'm about, hey, let's analyze and let's work and let's facilitate a plan that's going to help us to push forward. Now, pushing forward may mean that we can't go next year, that we have to wait 2 or 3 years and build up the grassroots effort, build up the education to our members, build up the contributions to our action committees. So it's what I see today, the most, if I was walking into a room, the most two most important questions I would be asking is, what percentage of your legislators have had a meeting with an optometrist within the last 6 to 12 months? And the last time you gave some kind of an education piece about what your legislative effort was, how many of your members attended that meeting? Not how many of your key persons, but just in general, how many of your members? And if those are low numbers, that is an indication of low engagement by the association, and it's an indication of unpreparedness to the legislator optometry relationship. And it's really hard to pass scope in 2024 without those on your side. It's hard enough to pass it already, but if you don't have those, it's a gut check and just a thing that we have to look back and say, look, you're not ready. Let's build this back up and then let's go, so that you are not having to go multiple times. And that is another piece that comes in, I'll say, in the Virginia model. Like, we don't offer, fail, go again, fail, go again, fail. Our philosophy is, look, we're going to go once. And I'll tell you that, and as you know, if you don't know the votes going into before the bill drops, if you don't know the votes already, then you're not quite ready yet. You need firm commitments from your health committee, if it's scope, or from wherever else, to know that you're really going to put forth your greatest effort.
You know, that I think that I totally agree with that, and I think it's very hard because, you know, on the one hand, you know, your hired guns, the lobbyists and the executive director, they are there. They know they're part of their value. What they see as part of their value is like doing stuff, right? It's like, excuse me. It's like, you know, we're going to want to pay them. We're already paying them. They view themselves as like, this is part of my role. But, yeah. but what I think is so important is that they see that as their role. And they do those things that they're being paid for, but also how do they get the doctors that are coming up to realize, like, it's not just about what I do. I can't do this. And it has to be more than words. It has to be actions. So, you know, I think one of the things I've noticed is that really effective leaders in both of those positions will obviously recognize that there are certain things that doctors don't want and can't do that are logistical. But there are certain things that they cannot do. If they recognize that, like, hey, I can't, you know, if we've got, like, as you said, if we've got 50% of our, you know, our key contacts at our legislative conference, it's not a good look, right? It's not gonna work. So what do we need to do from a messaging standpoint? What do we need from our leadership to help light a fire underneath those people? That's how those people that are really effective in those positions I see across the country, is they can help light the fires underneath the OD so that they can bring the groundswell up to have the doctors making the contacts and making the constant communication. When you look at who is driving the bus in a lot of these organizations that are moving forward, is it guys that are kind of our ilk, you know, 40s and 50s, or is it 30s and 40s? What are you seeing as kind of the generation, or maybe the decade that's driving this forward?
I think that the driving force of a lot of it is ODs in their 40s and 50s. But you will not pass scope if you don't have the ODs in their 20s and the ODs in their 60s and 70s. Like, we need them all. So you need a level of influence around your membership, and you need a level of experience. So again, I'll go back to the Virginia model. When it was Jerry and Lisa and I who were the main people getting up in front of our people. And at that time, we never surveyed our members. We felt in our heart of hearts, we needed laser in Virginia. And so we said, here's the plan, here's the time frame, here's what we're going to do. And at the time that we unveiled that to our people, we also had some people who were older, who were going to be able to stand up to say, I did this in the 90s. I said back in the 90s, I don't think we need glaucoma. I was wrong. We need this, and we need to build this over time. And so you need some people who are more veterans of optometry than we are to be able to stand up. And you need some people who are on the young side to be able to stand up and say, hey, we need to do this. And so if you don't have it widespread, then it's an uphill battle.
The most common questions I get include, what ophthalmological codes or evaluation and management codes should I use? What ICD-10 codes do I need to bill with this CPT code? What CPT codes can be billed together and what can't? And my favorite, how do I manage a patient who has diabetes who comes in for a quote-unquote routine eye exam? These questions really highlight the confusion and uncertainty that serves as a daunting hurdle for providers, makes it more challenging for them to care for their patients and provide those patients with the best opportunity for a lifetime of ocular health and clear vision. That's why we built iCode Education for this specific purpose. Our mission is to provide optometrists with resources to help you understand disease states, revenue cycles, and billing and coding so that you can put that on autopilot and truly care for your patients. Check out iCodeEducation.com. That's E-Y-E-C-O-D-E education.com. We've developed a premier billing and coding bundle that includes all of our billing and coding resources in one place. We also have a 10% discount code just for listeners of this podcast. Enter the coupon code EYECODEMEDIA22 at checkout. We'd love to work with you. Check out iCodeEducation.com. One of the challenging things with patients is that when they invest in a really high quality pair of glasses and customized lenses, occasionally it can be difficult to keep those lenses clean, scratch free, and smudge free. Now, we have the ability with Crizal Sapphire HR lenses to offer our patients a best-in-class anti-reflective coating that is also resistant to scratches, smudges, and deposits. This means that patients spend more time enjoying clear and comfortable vision and less time caring for their lenses. So remember that you can provide patients with the best-in-quality, best-in-class transparency, clarity, durability, and UV protection in a single Crizal coating. If you want to learn more about Crizal Sapphire HR, contact your Essilor account executive or visit EssilorPro.com/Crizal.
So I saw you were just, so this is kind of an interesting one because I think there's these kind of little sub-communities within the profession. One of the downsides I've seen since I've been in practice is this separation or this sub-sectioning of our profession where you have, you know, when I was training, right, we had our state associations and we had our national association. So it's the NOA, it was the Academy and AOA, right? AOA and then the Academy is kind of the scientific arm. But I'll tell you, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I see now we've got all this subsectioning. So even though, you know, the AOA has always been thought of as like, everybody all in. Now we have, you know, corporate optometrists, and then we have another subsectioning of, and I'm not saying this is wrong. I mean, obviously people have to be with their people, but then, you know, you have corporate optometrists, they have women in optometry. That's great. It's fine. I mean, it's not just fine. It's wonderful for them. But, you know, this subsectioning all over the place. And then you even get to the point of like, well, you know, you're an eye doc and I'm a vision source and they're a PERC and they're a PECA. And like all of these different organizations that, you know, I don't necessarily think that they're working. I mean, I don't think they're at all working against the profession in total. But when you get so focused on your little area, I think it can be problematic that we don't have this common purpose and this common goal. And maybe it's just an observation of what happens across the country, but just, you know, and other things that are not optometry related, but I do see it. Am I seeing something that's not really there, or do you feel that same problem that we have as a potential?
I do think that there's a lot of organizations out there that are subsectioning the profession. At the end of the day, I really feel like it's on our state association to meld all these groups together so that we're all still with that common underlying feeling of we're here to take care of patients in the best way possible. And so you look at some of the surgery subgroups that are now forming and some of the other types of groups that are forming, you know, at the end of the day, there's got to be somebody who's helping to bring all of them still together. And that's what I think the state association is. That state association and local society are still the core piece that are helping bring us all together. And so in Virginia, we are actively looking at how can we make this opportunity of camaraderie, this opportunity of melting together to be a little bit more taken by more of our members. We have great growing numbers, but we're not at the caliber of Iowa or some of the states that have really super high percentages. So I think it's really on the state association and the local society to help bridge that gap so that there is still some commonality.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I hope that, I'm not saying that. I'm not bringing that up to make this statement of like, well, when I was a kid, this. But I do see it as a potential problem. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think you're right. I think it's up to the state association to kind of bring everybody together. But also, you know, when you're there, I think I have to be aware also. You know, from my perspective is because I can get like this. Is, you know, I'm a practice owner. I do a lot of things outside of the practice, but I can't be, I have to make sure I'm not aloof and I'm not numb to the kind of day-to-day pains that somebody else might go through, right? Like somebody who doesn't own a practice or somebody who is in a corporate practice, you know, maybe they're an associate in a private practice or they're in a corporate practice or they're in a private equity group. I can't be numb. You know, sometimes it's easy to get aloof and I try not to do that, but I think it's incumbent upon us as, you know, people within the organization, people that would recognize us because we're around a lot, to try to step out of our comfort and welcome. And I need to be better about that for sure. Of like, just realizing like, hey, we're all in this together. And how do I find those people who, have different situations than I have and make them, you know, make them a part of the bigger group. I need to be better at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you think about, in your working across the country, docs getting right out of school, how much do they care about this in general?
I think that the newer graduates are oftentimes surprised to understand that I was doing these procedures in school and I just moved to this place that I love. And I heard people telling me that it was a legislative profession, but it did not sink in until I discovered I couldn't do A, B, and C. And I think that the new grads are way more educated about scope than when I was coming out. And they're eager to practice at the very height of what they have. And so I think that it's going to become a bigger issue. It's already been an issue, but it's going to become a bigger issue for states that have less scope. It's going to be a bigger issue to grow that piece of optometry in their state. And, you know, right now the Academy of Ophthalmology really puts out some information that, you know, Minnesota is growing leaps and bounds over the past few years. So the scope must not be influencing their ability to retain people. What they, of course, fail to indicate is there's a lot more schools and a lot more graduates than there had been in the 10 years prior. So you're going to get some natural accumulation of people coming back to Minnesota. But if you look at the numbers over time, I promise you that that lacking scope is a significant issue for many states.
Well, it's not just that, but the other thing that it fails to do. I mean, again, the ophthalmology is very good at picking and choosing data that benefits them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure if SGRC has had this analysis. I think I handed over some of what I did, but you know, I analyzed in 2022 at, I think it was at ARVO, there was a poster that showed that there was no increase in average drive time to get an SLT specifically in Kentucky or Louisiana or Oklahoma since implementing those scopes of practice. But
right.
But what you actually, so that was their conclusion. That was the big headline from their poster, which has subsequently been published. But actually, all you have to do is look at their counties and the populations that now have access to, you know, within a smaller, you know, with a very small range, these basically towns that didn't have any access to SLT now had access. So it was something like, I can't remember off the top of my head, it was like 14 counties in Oklahoma, 4 counties in Kentucky, 5 counties in Louisiana. But the point was, is that like still within all of that, even though the average drive time is not really significantly impacted, those communities that now had access to that are impacted. And so it would be like, it's false to say like, okay, well in Nebraska, 50% of the population lives in Omaha or Lincoln. So if I had just one SLT, and actually between Omaha and Lincoln, there's about a 60-minute drive. So if I put in Ashland, which is halfway between Lincoln and Omaha, I put one SLT, just one, in Ashland. And I said, you know, 50% of the population has access within 30 minutes to an SLT, then that's access? I mean, that's why how disingenuous it is, right?
Yeah.
But you have a, you know, 2 million people or maybe even more that live between Lincoln and Omaha that would be within a half hour's drive time of that one specific SLT. And then we could say the same thing about, well, we could put one ophthalmologist there and say, well, access isn't an issue. There's an ophthalmologist that's in Ashland. Well, I mean, that could be the only ophthalmologist in the whole entire place. And so your point about Minnesota, it's also disingenuous because we know that people are moving to bigger cities.
Mm-hmm.
And even within bigger cities, people are finding themselves in these smaller pockets as well. So, you know, even in Omaha, if you think about SLT, because that's obviously, they've been thinking a lot about that. But if you think in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, 1 million population, there's tons of ophthalmologists and tons of optometrists. But there are pockets, you know, if you go from like practically speaking, SLT, you know, 100 and I'm trying to think the furthest west, I mean, there's probably the closest SLT from Omaha to Lincoln, which is 60 miles away, is probably about 168th and Center. So just to give you some perspective, you know, every 12 blocks is a mile and it borders at the river where Nebraska meets Iowa. So once you get from there to 60 miles away, there's no SLT availability. So, I mean, that will mean like as far as convenience goes, you know, at minimum, a 20 to 25 minute drive time for somebody at the outskirts of Omaha and to get into that facility and to see one of those providers. Now, is that burdensome? I mean, there's a whole other access point that you would make. I mean, obviously, it's probably not burdensome from a time standpoint. But look, people choose to see, you know, Jeff Michaels for their care. They've trusted Jeff Michaels for their care. They want to continue to trust Jeff Michaels for their care. They don't. And so, like, it's a whole other side of just access as being a distance thing, but also, like, being a trust thing and being like, I want my doctors to be able to do what they can do. I trust my doctors to be able to take care of me the way they can take care of me. It's a whole other thing that's disingenuous about plotting something out on a map or seeing how many people are coming back to a state because of their, you know, scope of practice.
In touching on that access piece in the plots, so Ophthalmology's newest publication, which came out either at the end of 2023 or early 2024, will claim to say, you know, everybody lives within 30 or 60 minutes of an ophthalmologist. But it's interesting because they'll put on a map, you know, for an SLT, the pediatric ophthalmologist is counted the exact same as the general ophthalmologist, or the retina specialist who's never going to do an SLT is going to get counted the same as a general ophthalmologist or even a specialist. So they're doing a good job of what they do. It's on us to continue to stay on top of what are the talking points. But as you know, these talking points haven't changed since 1980. Some of the dynamics have a little bit, but at the end of the day, they're always going to say that we don't have the education, training, or certification to do these procedures, and it's on us to convey a message which cannot come down to the session that happens. These discussions with our legislators have to be happening years in advance so that they fully understand the depth and knowledge of what we're doing and how we're providing care for our patients every day.
Yeah, I think to wrap all of this up in a bow, you know, the most important part about all of it is that there is not going to be one beautiful articulated argument that is going to convince a legislature at one time that we are in the right. Ultimately, they're going to have to come down to facing two contradictory statements from two people that they trust and being able to say, I trust this one. I think this is going to be fine. I mean, ultimately, we can have all the best arguments. We can have all the data on our side, and we do. But it's not going to come down to that. It's going to come down to what was the relationship that we had, and when they're faced with that option, will they trust us? And unfortunately, in Nebraska, we are currently on an island. We will be on an island if as we started this conversation, if South Dakota gets signed, we will be on an island surrounded by Iowa with much greater scope of practice, South Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado. It'll be us and Kansas that will be on an island. I think Kansas is probably, based on where they are, I think they're not going to be long. And so we've got to figure that out as a, you know, if I'm reveling in my specific state, we're going to have to figure that out. But it won't be because of fancy arguments and really well done studies. We have those. It will be relationships. So yeah. I'll let you have the last word, Dr. Michaels.
So at the end of the day, the State Government Relations Committee is ready to help every state advance their scope. But what it really is going to come down to is every state and every optometrist being able to create relationships with legislators to teach them what we do every day. And that's the important key, is teaching them now what we do every day. You can't wait until you're ready to pass scope. This has to start years in advance. And you have to be willing to understand there's going to be legislator turnover. There's going to be governor turnover. There's going to be lots of things that make you have to go through the same discussions over and over again. But over time, it is something that will benefit your state, this profession, and the people you serve and care for all the time.
I couldn't end it better than that. Dr. Michaels, thanks so much for coming on again. I really appreciate it.
Love you, Chris. Thank you.
Love you too, brother. We'll see you soon.